This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
From the Fox News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. 1-866-408-7669. Rich Lowry is going to be with us this hour. Ambassador Monica Crowley is going to be here. Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann is also going to be with us today. And we have so much going on. I mean, literally, I could have had a big nine, but instead a big three. So let's bring in Rich Lowry. He's editor of National Review, author of The Case for Nationalism. And we're talking about a series of wins for the President of the United States. Now, Rich, I was just listening to him even before reading your article. I just thought to myself, I've never seen a role like this. Now, some people might not like it, but you talk about, first, hello, Rich.
Hey.
How about the border crossings down to zero? How about the massive crackdown on TDA? How about the destroyed Iran nuclear program after thinking about it for 40 years? How about on the precipice of ceasefire with Hamas? The record. The market hits a record high. We're at the doorstep of the big, beautiful bill, the win against CBS. The Supreme Court neutralizes district courts. The tariffs have brought in $162 billion, got Canada to cave. Virginia president is out. The UPenn undoes the trans man rule and then wins and gets
amazing.
An apology. So this is just,
amazing.
I say, let me just jot some of these down. What are your thoughts?
You just left one out that's
what?
Truly historic, the NATO 5%.
Yes.
We'll see whether they follow through, but that could be an enduring contribution to Western military strength, right? And everyone's talked about it. Every administration has talked about it. Bob Gates gave these speeches scolding them. But it was Trump doing it his way, putting the fear of God into them, saying he was going to pull out of NATO, right? Which I never liked because I like NATO.
Sure.
But then he gets what he wants out of them, and he says NATO's great. So it's just like a classic Trump negotiation. And the UPenn thing, I've read the statement several times now from that university. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable that they're going to admit this is wrong. They're going to apologize to the female athletes. They're going to correct the records. It's crazy. Yeah, it's been an extraordinary run the last 2 weeks.
It really has. Now, think about this. The standoff at Harvard, the look at anti-Semitism on the campus, the proof that it's actually happened, the testimony from the students. It's not nobody's agenda. It's not a political party that has advantage. There's right and wrong. Well, what can you do about it? Well, you can do a lot about it. How about take their money away? Oh, you can't do that. No, I'm doing that. And now all of a sudden, Columbia. I was talking to Jay Johnson last week. He's joining the Columbia board. They're looking to do a deal right now. Yale is in compliance, it looks like. And now you have Harvard trying to figure out a way to pay their legal bills and maybe come to some type of deal with the President of the United States. But most importantly, Rich, it's not just about conservative or liberal. It's about anti-American and anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so if he gets a deal with Harvard that even gets like 20% of what he's been talking about he wants, would be another just historic achievement. And again, it goes to his methods. Like with Harvard, I think if this goes all the way through the courts, he'll end up losing because I don't think he's dotted the I's and crossed the T's procedurally on a bunch of stuff. But just the fact that he's doing it and threatening them and putting the fear of God in them may be enough to get the deal so you don't have to have the litigation. And you have a handshake agreement, you know, written down that puts Harvard in a better place. So that'd be amazing, too.
Yeah. I mean, for example, by exposing it's Harvard, by exposing what they're doing, they're losing. And they just talked about how their money, how much they need this money. And they say, well, you don't need money. You have $53 billion. Well, not really. The endowment's got specific things it can go into. And I did not know this, but I'm looking in detail. Harvard's got investments, and a lot of this stuff is not liquid. So they're scrambling. I'm not saying that they need, you know, their $70,000 tuition from everybody, but things aren't, they're not exactly, you know, home free.
Yeah, so it's not easy for them. They prefer not to be in this place, and they're dealing with what they have to consider across the negotiating table or across the courtroom, an implacable foe. With all these various strings he can pull. So you're looking at that, maybe just like, you know what? We'll just become a better place and sign the agreement and move on. So that's the calculation other universities have made, and people are hailing Harvard for making a different one, but they might end up at the same place.
All right, so let's talk about the big, beautiful bill. It's not perfect, but, man, it is historic, and it's through the Senate. It's now back to the House, and they say it's 85% of what the House gave the Senate. Here's our Treasury Secretary, cut to.
This is the signature piece of President Trump's domestic agenda. This is more than a tax bill because it also includes border, it includes defense, it includes school choice. And, you know, I just had a meeting with some of the House Democrats, the Freedom Caucus, and I can tell you that group should be so proud of themselves. They have changed the center of gravity in the debate. We are going to start paying down debt. We're going to grow the economy. And they were big contributors to this. So I believe that at the end of the day, they will be there for President Trump and give Speaker Johnson the ability to move this bill to the president's desk for signing this Friday.
So I have $3.3 billion to hire immigration judges, $7 billion more Border Patrol, $32 billion for immigration enforcement, $46 billion to build the wall, $170 billion to fund the Trump administration's overall immigration, and but $160 billion to, in addition to add to the Defense Department. So what are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, it's an imperfect bill, but there's a lot of good stuff in it, and it would be a debacle if it didn't pass. We'd get the biggest tax increase in American history and wouldn't get a lot of these initiatives that we desperately need, the more money for immigration enforcement and defense, really high on the list. So I don't know whether it passes the House. I assume if Johnson just says, I need this and the president wants it right now, they'll get the votes. But let's say it's delayed, you know, a couple of weeks because they change it a little and it goes back to the Senate and the Senate has to go through all the rigmarole of the process. It doesn't really matter. Get in the scheme of things, another month or whatever doesn't matter. It's going to pass. It's going to be a big victory for the president. He wants it on July 4th, a big showy holiday. I think he probably gets it, but it's not a disaster if he, you know, signing it on July 31st instead.
Rich, I disagree. If it goes back to the Senate, it explodes. I'm telling you, because Murkowski's on a knife's edge. It's not going to get better in Collins' eyes. And Tillis and Rand Paul are dug in. So I don't know if you just don't lose somebody after that. You know, you might have to lean on Fetterman, but he's not going that far. Ralph Norman of North South Carolina says he does not expect to vote for the Senate version, opposes advancing it. Chip Roy warned that the odds of passing of the spending package before the fourth deadline are not good. Says this version are a hell of a lot lower. The chances of this version passing are a hell of a lot lower than they were 48 hours ago. So he's upset. Elon Musk is upset, and he's weighing in, and he's saying the most horrific things about the bill. And your thoughts about why he keeps choosing to weigh in?
Well, I mean, this is the way he communicates. He's a lot like Trump in that respect. It's never modulated or nuanced, right? It's always taken to 11. And look, the bill's not perfect. It's not great in a lot of respects. It would be better if there were 20 votes margin in the House for Republicans, but there's not. So it's either this or nothing. And clearly, this is better than nothing. And I have the highest respect for Elon. I mean, he really is a genius, but I think he's totally unreasonable on these sort of questions, and he's not going to start a political party that's going to primary every Republican who votes for it, because it's going to be that'd be every Republican in the country more or less. So that's just absurd.
So Rich, there's going to be other opportunities and to go back again, and they have the opportunity to do reconciliation with this Congress. That's what Kim Strassel of the Wall Street Journal thinks that people should keep that in mind. Cut 14.
It's the cost cutters that are a problem. But I think Hugh just hit on the thing that could allow this to go forward, which is they're not happy. They'd like to see significantly more in deficit cuts, deficit cutting in this bill. But if they can't get it, can the administration somehow promise that a second bill or a panel to look more closely at the budget or rescissions bills that they send along can satisfy them a little bit down the road? That's going to be key to this, because there's a significant number of House Republicans in that block that are not happy with that number for in the end.
So, I mean, that's one promise you could do. And, you know, they do want to cut. But if you cut on the entitlements, you definitely are worried about the midterms, even though it's the responsible thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, the politics are just really difficult. Yeah, so but something like that promise will be made. And look, they should be doing rescissions. I mean, everything that DOGE came up with should be in a rescission package and written into law, so there's not any chance of a court reversing it and say, no, you actually have to spend the money. But just in terms of – I love Chip Roy. In terms of what he wants from this bill, he's never going to get it. It's just you need – as I say, you need 20 more Republican votes and a lot more people committed to fiscal responsibility the way he is.
Thanks so much, Rich. And I'll tell you, I'll take a Chip Roy. I'll take a Ron Johnson. Rick Scott, they're upset about the bill. So they go in and change it. They lobby for it. They go public and they try to pressure people. That's fine. That's because you have a job to do the best you can to get the most you can for the people that put you there and the country. When Rand Paul and Tom Massey, that's it. I'm not voting for it. What? What do you mean? Go tell me what you want better. Well, Rand Paul, they brought him into the office and they said, Senator Paul, what do you need? What could we do? He goes, I don't want anything. So I'm not voting for it. I have no patience for that. I had to get that off my chest. Thanks, Rich. When we come back.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Brian. I thought you let me go. Already.
No. But no, I appreciate
you.
I just want people to get busy. Don't just say, I don't like it. Just to try to make it better. Rich, Larry, thanks so much. Pick up the National Review. Meanwhile, Ambassador Monica Crowley is next, Chief of Protocol for the State Department Administration. Why? America 250 is upon us. July 4th celebrations begin. A big announcement yesterday. Monica Crowley will bring you the details today. Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. The Brian Kilmeade Show coming up in about 15 minutes. Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann. We're going to talk about what's next in the Middle East. We hear about possible ceasefire with Gaza. In Gaza, Hamas basically has the offer. President says that Israel has come aboard. Got to get the hostages out. We'll see if that comes to a head, Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann. But right now, let's bring in Ambassador Monica Crowley, Chief of Protocol at the State Department with the administration and in charge. Huge task. She's representing America 250. Even though we're at 249, the war really started in 1775. Ambassador Monica Crowley, you've noted that. You've also noted the 4th of July is coming. And suddenly, this new job you have, your plate is full.
Hi, Brian. Great to be back with you. Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, you know, when the president offered me the position as Chief of Protocol of the United States, he also said, well, Monica, I'm going to tack something else onto your job responsibilities. And I said, yes, Mr. President, whatever you need, what is it? And he said, well, I would really love for you to be America's representative and my administration's representative to these huge U.S.-hosted events, including America 250, the FIFA World Cup next year, and the Olympic Games coming in 2028 in LA. And I said, absolutely. And I have to tell you, Brian, as full as my plate is, it is an absolute honor and blessing, especially to be talking about America's 250th birthday.
All right. So let's talk about what's happening. Iowa's the first stop, July 3rd. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so tomorrow we are doing the official kickoff for America 250, and I want to encourage all of your listeners to please visit America250.org, America250.org. That is the central website. That is the central location to find out all details and information, not just about tomorrow's event, but also about events happening nationwide over the next year, heading into July 4th of next year. And we also have state-by-state breakouts, too, on that website. So if you're not in New York or Washington over the next year, you can find out what's happening in your neck of the woods. Tomorrow is our big kickoff event. It is taking place at the Iowa State Fairgrounds in Des Moines, Iowa. And we selected that because the president loves the Iowa State Fair. It's also the American heartland, Brian, right smack in the middle of the country. And the entire purpose of America 250 is to really to try to bring the country together, to unite the nation through patriotism, shared values, and this renewed sense of civic pride, all of which President Trump is bringing to pass for the country. So tomorrow we're kicking it off at the Iowa State Fair. The president is going to be the headline speaker. I am going to be speaking right before him, so I'm very honored to do so. And we're going to have live musical acts. We're going to have dazzling displays and, of course, fireworks.
Right. And then so Washington, July 4th, too, right?
Yes. So the next day we'll be back in Washington, and it's going to be the national fireworks display. And also the president wanted to do something really special this year as we kick off 1 year toward America 250. He is going to be inviting the pilots that flew the mission into Iran to the White House for July 4th. So they will be there with the president to observe the fireworks. And we're going to have a very special flyover of the B-2s, the F-22s, and the F-35s that flew the mission. So if you're in Washington, you want to join us for that, America250.org, come out and see it all.
Well, that's fascinating. When you look at overall, I'm so glad for many reasons President Trump's president, but one of the main reasons, he loves the country. I think Joe Biden would have and Barack Obama would have been apologizing the whole time. You know, sorry about this, sorry about that. There's not a great sense of patriotism. I saw a survey that said 85% of Republicans feel great pride for the country, at 44% of Democrats. How did that separation happen, Monica? You've been in politics since Nixon.
Well, in Nixon's last years, Brian, let's be very clear.
Yeah, a lot younger than that, but still.
Yes. Look, I think there has been a longstanding chipping away on the left of American values and our history and our traditions. You see it everywhere in our education, the tearing down of statues, in the culture, movies, television, music, all of it. It has been a multi-pronged assault on America coming from the left. So unfortunately, that number doesn't surprise me on the Democrat side. But what President Trump has done, and he genuinely loves America, which is why he took this on to begin with 10 years ago, right? Because he saw that nobody was speaking for the forgotten men and women. And he looked around, he waited decades for somebody to stand up and do it. Nobody did it. And he said, okay, fine, I'll do it. And he's done it in such an exceptional way in terms of literally making America great again. And so what we're celebrating here, and by the way, Brian, you're absolutely right. What a gift it is to have President Trump in office during America's 250th birthday. Because you're right, if it had been the other team, forget it. Kamala Harris would have put out a statement, and that would have been the extent of it. But we're doing a year-long celebration of American history, leadership, strength, patriotism, and pride. We're going to have a year-long celebration in all 50 states and U.S. territories.
So that's going to be great. Monica, best of luck. It's really good. If you think this is busy, and I know it is, but man, can you imagine what next year is going to be like? Also, a year from today, you got the World Cup going to be raging across North America.
Yes, and in fact, Brian, next July 4th, so literally the day of America's 250th birthday, we are going to have a World Cup match being played in Philadelphia, and I can guarantee you that it's probably going to be the U.S. versus the U.K., right?
That would be great, and I hope we win just like we did the first time. It'll be even a bigger upset if we do it on the soccer field. Thanks, Monica.
Thanks for listening. Do you like true crime podcasts? If so, check out Unsolved with James Patterson. Listen ad-free on Amazon Music or just say, Alexa, play the podcast Unsolved with James Patterson on Amazon Music.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
No, I think it's a bad move, Brett. And I thought that President Trump and President Zelensky had a very good meeting at the NATO summit. I think they had discussed mutually beneficial exchanges of weaponry. I don't know what this review is. I don't know what the specifics are. But the more weapons that can get to Ukraine right now, important because there is an offensive coming from Russia in the summer. And I know that part of that 5% NATO commitment that President Trump got out of the NATO was sort of premised on the idea that if Europe steps up, we'll step up. So I hope that this is not too much and it can be reversed if it is.
Right. So that's the report that UU was commenting on. There's a report today. The Pentagon has frozen some shipments of critical weapons to Ukraine, including Patriot missile interceptors, 155-millimeter artillery shells at a pivotal time, obviously, in the conflict. This is North Korea commits to putting, what, 150,000 or 30,000 troops in there? And they mostly come back in caskets, but it doesn't seem to bother them. Let's bring in Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann, conducting a coordinated task force. Pineapple, as you know, author of Nobody Is Coming to Save You, A Green Beret's Guide to Getting Big Stuff Done. First off, Scott, your thoughts about keeping some of these shipments back. Now we got to get the mic up. Yeah, we just, Scott, just hold on 1 second. I don't think we have your mic up yet. Because one of the reasons he did this, they say that we're running out of stockpiles. I get it. But this is, they said they got to keep America's interest first, and I understand it. But Elbridge Colby is somebody that's never been pro-Ukraine, doesn't think we belong in the war. I guess it's okay for Russia just to take countries because he wants to focus on China. It makes no sense. So let's try it again. Scott, your thoughts, let me ask you the question again. Your thoughts about holding the weapons back.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Brian. As a former combat advisor, you know, someone that spent most of his adult life working by, with, and through indigenous populations, I think the way that our political leadership over the last couple of administrations have operated with our partner nations is not good. And this is part of that. I don't think that you start at combat advising in a place like Ukraine and then you just end it, right? You just stop it. Whether you agree with that move politically or not, what that does just in the scheme of things, in terms of how you're dealing with an insurgency, how you're dealing with a hostile threat, what that does to the partner force, you know, it is, it's just, to me, it's just not a way that America does things. If we're going to step into a conflict and we're going to combat advise, then if we're going to exit, we need to exit responsibly. And do it in such a way that it does not leave our partners in a lurch.
Yeah, Come on, Scott. I know, listen, we have to have Patriots, got to defend ourselves. But it's hard to believe that we suddenly looked around and said, where's the Patriot missiles? Oh, we got to cut off Ukraine or in a hot war with Russia. That's in our national interest to make sure that Russia doesn't take Kyiv.
100%. And you know, you're talking about working with surrogates here. I mean, this is the stuff to me, even within the Trump doctrine, working by, with, and through indigenous populations to stand against tyranny, whether that's Russia, North Korea, the Taliban, ISIS. I mean, look, Brian, you and I have talked about this. I think we're deluded in this world if we think that two oceans are going to keep bad actors from moving on us. We have to work with partners. We have to work with third parties. And if we tick off everybody that we work with, it's just like, you know, in kindergarten, you're going to end up alone with a lot of people circling you in the playground.
And I understand, too, talking to Lindsey Graham and talking to other people, the president's fed up with Putin. You know, he took great political risks to give this guy a lifeline, in order to give him an off ramp to stop the fighting. Do you know he's losing 300 to 400 people a day? He's lost over 1 million people. It's leaked out. I mean, dead or wounded, no longer on the battlefield. He's begging Yemen for people. North Korea is sending their people into wood chippers. And Ukraine is finding a way to survive. A nation of 44 million being invaded by a nation of 150 million. They want. Scott, you know what it's like having people, you read about the South Vietnamese didn't want to fight. You read about the Northern Alliance didn't really have any conviction in some cases. They didn't want to fight. That's not the problem here.
Yeah.
These guys want to fight.
Well, and also I think a lot of cases too, if I'm being honest, a lot of times the narrative that comes out of these other places that you just cited is a lot of it's a false narrative. I mean, like if you look at the people that Pineapple and other groups helped get out, these guys ran out of ammunition. Like they literally fought to the last round. And some of them, for example, in Afghanistan are still fighting. I think the problem for me is that when you step into a relationship with a partner nation and you say, okay, we're going to send our blood and treasure and we're going to fight alongside you, or even if we just send equipment, when you do that, it is a commitment. It is an implicit and explicit promise that we're with you. And then when you just pull it back, on some political whim or on some, you know, in my assessment, wildly, you know, just ineffective isolationist strategy, what you're going to end up doing is isolating yourself. You're going to isolate yourself. And when bad times come, those people that you do need at your shoulder are not going to be there. And I feel like that's what we've done here.
And I think Wall Street Journal's Kim Strassel had pretty much agrees with you. Cup 47.
Your stockpile point is really important, Brett. From what I've seen of this report, this was comes after a review saying that our stockpiles are low enough that they are now concerned about continuing to ship more of these weapon systems over to Ukraine because it would leave us shortchanged. And I think that gets back to the importance of this Senate bill because it was overlooked. But a piece of it, an important piece, is a plus up that we are giving to the military. And part of that money will indeed be directed to speeding up and expanding productions of munitions and other important pieces of military equipment that we are behind on because we've been aiding our allies.
You're the so and now the question is what's going to happen next as they try to hold on. I think you have Macron going over there breaking the ice. He hadn't spoken to Vladimir Putin in 2 years. Now he's going to speak to him again, and we'll see how serious he is. And also, I think we found out too that this alliance isn't nearly as strong as everyone thought. Russia has left Iran just out in the lurch. They took all that technology from the drones. They took all Iran's drones. I imagine they paid for them. But when Iran needed them, they did nothing, and I'm glad they didn't. And China did nothing either.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in working by, with, and through partner nations. I'm a big believer in it. And I do believe that it does require something of us to do that. It can't just be, yeah, you know, Israel, we approve you standing up against Hamas and Hezbollah. We have to demonstrate a resolve to stand at their shoulder. And we've done that in some capacity. But Brian, when I go back to you, man, and maybe I just can't get off of it, but I spent most of my life, at least my adult life, fighting in Afghanistan. I lost a lot of friends there. And I look at what, you know, we are still to this day, we are still talking to the Haqqani regime. We are dealing directly with the Taliban on counterterrorism. And there are commandos right now that are fighting and dying over there, who are still trying to hold the line and are reporting back to veterans saying Al-Qaeda is getting stronger. ISIS is getting stronger. It's coming. And yet we're still dealing directly with a terrorist regime and normalizing our relations with them. So you know what's hard for me? It's hard for me to even think about Ukraine or China or anything else because we created such a moral injury on an entire generation of veterans and our partners that I can't hardly get past that.
Yeah, let's also talk about Task Force Pineapple. You're presenting you're back on stage, presenting Last Out, Elegy of a Green Beret. You wrote the whole play. You're in it. It's at the Tally Ho Theater on July 8th and 9th in Leesburg, Virginia. What could you tell everybody about it?
Well, First of all, I appreciate you bringing it up, man. You've always been such a staunch supporter of this project. And, you know, I wrote the play because I wanted to educate Americans and politicians on the cost of modern war. And I wanted to validate those that lived it. Everybody in the play is either a veteran or a military family member. It is going to be in Leesburg, close to the National Capital Region. And the whole reason is right on the, you know, on the following of the 4th of July, this is an opportunity for us to sit down as a community and listen to veterans and family members tell us what it's like to live a life of modern war, a 20-year war, and the impact that it has, whether you agree with it or not. And we do a talk back after that. This is our third season now. We've toured with Gary Sinise. And what I will tell you, Brian, is that that's needed in this country more than anything else. Man, we turned the page on a 20-year war and, you know, 1.8 million veterans who gave a lot to keep this country safe. We literally turned the page on them like it never happened.
Yep.
And now we're going into all this other stuff. And we've left that GWAT generation behind with a pretty massive moral injury. And so what we're trying to do with the play in our own small way is to basically tell the story from the stage and let the audience go for the ride and let them feel what this is like to go to war as close as we can and have conversations around that so that we don't treat this thing like a video game in the future. Our kids are now fighting the war we didn't finish. And I worry that we're just not learning these lessons, man. We're just treating it like it's a video game, like these are expendable assets, and we can't do that. So that's what this play's about. I hope people will come out and check it out. It's a powerful story.
Yeah, patrons unable to attend can donate tickets to the performance for veterans. And where do they go for tickets?
You can go to taskforcepineapple.org.
Okay.
You know, get tickets right there. And again, 100% of the proceeds goes right back into our nonprofit to help veterans and first responders tell their story and heal. And again, man, I just want to thank you and Fox for everything you guys have done to help us put this story out there, because this is the only way I think we're going to bring our warfighters and their families home, is a peer-to-peer engagement and education of our own society, because we're forgetting the cost of war.
Let's just real quick on the president's decision to bomb out those three sites last week, Natanz, Fordo, and then the site where with the Tomahawks, which is where they take the uranium, they enrich it, turn it into a gas, and they'll put it onto a ballistic missile. All right. You for this move? You for that?
I think it was a solid decision. I think it was excellent targeting. Hats off to Hegseth and DOD for a surgical strike that no one in the world could ever pull off. I will go a step further, and the Green Beret in me is also for regime change. Bottom up, mobilize those factions inside Iran, and let's get those mullahs the hell out of there.
Yeah. Also, the fact is that Iran has a lot of American blood on their hands. 600-plus Americans lost their lives directly from Iranian operations in Iraq. That's just 600 in Iraq. The militias they sponsors, the EFPs they made.
The one thing I'll caution everybody on is if there is regime change, whether it's organic or not, or we foment it, we had better be paying attention to our homeland for what that could bring here with sleeper cells and other secondary and tertiary effects.
Right. And hope your neighbor's Scott Mann, because you'll be all right. At least that block will be. Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
You got it. When we come back, I'll open up the phones, 1-866-408-7669. And also talk about the mayor of New York City. This is a communist in the coal mine. We'll tell you about it.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I want to remind everybody that July 4th is canceled. The 4th of July. If I hear a single firework, if I see a barbecue out there, it is canceled.
We are expected to celebrate freedom when the truth is we are far from free. And our taxes pay for it. Honestly, think about it. Do you really believe you'll feel good this year standing there looking up at fireworks, pretending everything is okay? Instead, we reclaim the day with solidarity and silence.
So what was that, Allison? You just sprung on me.
You're welcome. That was a little montage of people on TikTok and other social platforms saying how much they love our country, and that's how they're going to celebrate the 4th, to sit at home and be miserable because you cannot look at fireworks.
Right. By the way, you have freedom to say what you said, but you have no freedom. You have freedom to burn an American flag, but you have no freedom. You have freedom to speak up and vote the way you want, but you have no freedom. People have to travel and understand what they have here, and all these people are sore losers. And nobody would ever stop me from celebrating America's birthday. I don't care who the president, the senator, the congressman is. Also, Alice, don't play TikTok. It's evil. It's from China. They're trying to spy on us.
So here's the thing, though. That's where the young, I don't want to say crazy, but, you know.
Well, we're about to sell it.
Well, that's hopefully
it's about
too.
To force a sale, but it's got to make sure.
But that's where we get the content that we love to react to comes from, unfortunately.
We can't find anything on Instagram or MySpace.
MySpace. Yeah, go log into your account from MySpace, Brian, see how that goes.
I am going to.
Who are your top eight?
I'm going to see. Some 80-year-olds are going to be on there, going to be telling me what's going on. But I'm amazed at this. I think I started the show this hour like this. I just wrote down some of the wins the president has had. Now, look, you vote for the president. A lot of times you look at things happen. It didn't go his way. I had 100 days. I remember doing One Nation on Sundays. And 100 days, the president was not hitting all the marks. The inflation was still going up. The tariffs were causing the market to decrease. There was no end to the war in Ukraine. The war in Gaza was hitting an all-time high. He didn't have his trip yet overseas, the first one where he began to bring in investments. And then things began to change. Now the market's on an all-time high. With or without tariffs and deals, he's got two deals done, the framework with China. He's got one with the UK. I think India's on the precipice and Japan's on the precipice and the EU's on the precipice. Without it, the market doesn't care. Booming. The big, beautiful bill is now on the doorstep of passing. Now you have his win against CBS and their new pledge to publish entire transcript of political figures along with the edited version. That is a win, and he gets more money, $16 billion for this library, which he already got money from ABC. The Virginia president, Mr. DEI, is out. NATO is now giving 5%. The University of Pennsylvania will no longer allow trans men to be in women's sports and apologize for the ones that lost medals or placements or trophies because of it. They all did this. He won a major case of the Supreme Court that stopped the district courts from stopping him. Border crossings down literally from now they have border apprehensions at 6,000. Do you know it was over 100,000 under Biden at some points? You know how many people got in? No. He's got the money for all of it coming in. Massive crackdown on TDA. The Iran nuke program, at least for now, has been destroyed. That's what this guy has done. And he's just getting started. And believe me, I think the economy is going to soar from here on in. If they can get a rate cut and then he can get this big, beautiful bill passed, he's going to be on a roll. Also, he's got the perfect, the Democrats can't get out of their own way. They have nominated a communist, literally a communist. That's called by the New Yorker a communist. He won the Democratic primary in New York City, likely to become the next mayor. Stephen A. Smith, put it in perspective, cut 31.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me be very, very clear. If the Democratic Party becomes the likes of Zohran Mamdani, who, by the way, I like, not trying to throw any shade on him or anything like that, but if the Democratic Party becomes him, you have no chance. You have no chance on a national basis in terms of the presidency. In Senate seats in the House, you have no chance. You have no chance. I want to be very, very clear about that. You might have a democratic socialist sprinkled here and there, but that ain't what America is. America's about capitalism. America's about dollars and cents. America's about an economy, a flourishing economy, okay? And you know what it's not about? Free stuff.
Thank you, but how could you start by saying I like him? What is there to like? He doesn't like the country. He doesn't like Jews. He hates Israel. Doesn't like democracy or capitalism. What is there to like? Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
From 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world, it's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Got a busy hour coming your way. The President of the United States hopes to get the big, beautiful bill passed. That's going to be big. We also have a situation with a lot of moving parts with Hamas. Has basically got a proposal for a ceasefire in their lap. They have very few, if I could use the president's term, cards to play. Sooner or later, the death cult is going to realize that, perhaps, and we can get the hostages back. Let's hope. Big three.
Number three.
We're going to be watching that very carefully, and a lot of people are saying he's here illegally. He's, we're going to look at everything. But ideally, he's going to turn out to be much less than a communist. But right now, he's a communist. That's not a socialist.
That is President of the United States talking about this, the winner of the Democratic nomination to be the next mayor of New York. Mr. Mamdani is a communist. If you read what he says, if you see what he believes, basically, it's from Karl Marx, from Brezhnev would have signed off on it. That's what we're looking at. And he's already warring with the President of the United States.
Number two.
I think it's anti-American. I think the fact that you're going to have individuals and populations in there that are stacked on top of each other, many of whom without due process.
There's nothing about this facility, about this detention camp that is not cruel and inhumane.
Really? Okay. Operation Alcatraz. We are talking about the crackdown on illegal immigrants in our country. Over a long time coming. A success story being written by President Trump in real time, but not without controversy. We'll discuss it all, along with his change of heart when it comes to people here who have been here a while.
Number one.
It's the most conservative piece of legislation we've ever worked on. You need to mention at the same time that even though while we're having historic tax cuts, we also have historic savings. We're going to save $1.6 trillion for the American people.
And that is the Speaker of the House hopes to get his house to agree to a bill that they handed over to the Senate, which is 85% like the one he handed over. But the last 15% might cause at least a delay. I'm talking about the big, beautiful bill. We'll talk about that in detail. It does provide over $170 billion in additional funds for the Pentagon. Joining us now is General H.R. McMaster, former National Security Advisor for Donald Trump's first administration, Hoover Institute senior fellow, and author of At War With Ourselves, My Tour of Duty in the Trump White House. Now it might be different now. General, welcome back.
Hey, Brian. Great to be with you.
All right. First off, let me give you an idea. There's so many different things happening right now. There's just a report out that it looks like we're going to stop sending Patriot missiles over to Ukraine because we're running low, along with certain artillery. I find that an excuse not to arm the Ukrainians. What's going on here?
Yeah, I think that's what it is, Brian. You know, there are certain people, you know, who are in the president's ear, like trying to tell him that, hey, you know, this is Europe's thing, you know, and we don't really have a stake in this. But hey, Brian, you know what they're missing is the connection between Vladimir Putin and the other leaders of the Axis of Evils. You know why they need those Patriots and other capabilities? Because, you know, North Korea has given them 8 million artillery rounds to the Russians. They fought alongside them. The Iranians gave them these Shahed drones, which Moscow has now modified, and they're targeting, you know, apartment buildings and hospitals and schools in Ukraine. And guess who's underwriting the whole effort? China. And so a lot of the people are making this kind of prioritizing argument that, hey, this is Europe's thing. We have to focus on China. It's all interconnected, Brian. And, you know, and the Ukrainians are demonstrating tremendous valor and fighting in our interest against this Axis of aggressors.
You know, it looks to be the Undersecretary of Defense, Elbridge Colby, who you might be familiar with. He, like other people, totally against our involvement with the Ukraine war. I don't understand, think they see the big picture like you just mentioned. That's just a small portion of it. And now all of a sudden he realizes and Jennifer Griffin's reporting, we have frozen shipments of critical weapons to Ukraine, including Patriot interceptors in 155 millimeter shells. At a pivotal time because they say we are running low. Do we need Patriots at this moment? And is it possible that we could protect ourselves with the Patriots that you think we have?
Absolutely, Brian. And you know, there's been some really good work on this. If you go to the Foundation of Defense of Democracy, they go through every critical weapon system and show, what's in stock and what needs to happen to ramp up production. It is true that our defense industrial base is atrophied, and that's one of President Trump's priorities. But we can do this, you know, and we have co-production with some countries. For example, in Japan, they produce some of these Patriot weapon systems. They've just approved that they can export to Taiwan some of these systems. So, hey, it's like an all-hands-on-deck moment, you know. Hey, we used to be the arsenal of democracy. Remember that in World War II, you know? Hey, let's be Americans, not Americans, Brian. You know, we can do this.
So the North Koreans are bringing, I think, up to 30,000 more troops over. I mean, they're basically all coming back in caskets. As you see, the North Korean leader seeing the caskets come back. Now they're getting experience fighting. Their word is they are improving. But the Russians are losing to 300 to 400 a day. Can you imagine this? If America was losing 300 guys a day?
Yeah, Brian, this is Putin's ruse, right? He's trying to look strong. He's throwing it all in right now because he thinks we don't have the will to support Ukraine. And he thinks that's going to affect Ukraine psychologically. And now is his moment. So, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, they're taking 30,000, 40,000 casualties a month. And by the way, Putin is really in a hurt in terms of his economic situation, right? He's sitting on top of piles of cash he can't convert. You know, he's spending about 49% of his budget on defense is not sustainable. Hey, oil prices are going down, so he's not pulling enough, as much out of the ATM as he's been able to pull. And you know, I think now's the time to be in a position of strength. And by the way, Putin has, you know, really disrespected President Trump the whole time, you know, and thinks he can play him. I don't think he can play Donald Trump. You saw what happened, you know, with the Iranians. He gave him 60 days, right? And they went to 61 and he acted. Remember what with Kim Jong-un? Kim Jong-un thought he could get everything he wanted from Donald Trump in the Hanoi summit in Trump's first administration. And Donald Trump walked out. So hey, I think President Trump is going to come to the conclusion it's time to put more pressure on Putin, and that includes sustaining support for the Ukrainians.
Lindsey Graham thinks the president's close to allowing that Senate bill, which was, I think, got over 80 votes, to go in to put additional sanctions on Putin. And he could use that as a lever, use that as leverage and say, guys, I'm just going to sign this. This is the Senate. They're going to put additional sanctions on him. Some just roll their eyes when I say sanctions. Are you one of them?
No, I'm not. Because, you know, in fact, we did a study here at the Hoover Institution that I recommend on sanctions. What effect of sanctions? I'll send you the link to that, Brian. But, you know, I'll tell you, it's really how they're implemented and how. Yeah. What President Trump showed is, hey, on Iran, it's not military force or diplomacy or military force or sanctions. It's how you integrate all those elements of national power. That's what needs to happen in all elements of foreign policy. Sanctions are a part of the answer. They're not the answer.
All right, let's talk about Iran. I haven't talked to you about the operation. You must have known this operation existed and the capabilities that our B-2 bombers had and the bunker busters were revealed to have. Your thoughts about the operation when you left it and how it was executed when you saw it?
Hey, it was executed brilliantly. You know, I mean, this I'd love to see, obviously, the professionalism, the courage of our armed forces. And also, you know, you've got to also give credit to the Israelis for what they did to dismantle the air defense system and then to go after the nuclear supply chain, to also go after the missile capabilities and to go after some of the leadership, you know, the critical leadership within the IRGC, as well as the scientists and so forth. But, you know, I'll tell you, I think that was an important message to our adversaries. I mean, who else can fly a 37-hour round trip and put 30,000-pound bombs down ventilation shafts, you know, and to do that as part of an overall strike package that included, you know, submarine-launched cruise missiles. So it was a fantastic display of American military prowess, and it was a righteous mission, Brian. I mean, you got to look at the nature of the Iranian regime, right? What they say. They call us the Great Satan. They've killed, you know, thousands of Americans over the years through their proxies. They want to destroy Israel and wipe them off the map. Hey, I mean, you can't let Ayatollah Khamenei get the most destructive weapons on Earth.
What do we find out about their defensive ability, their offensive ability, and their vulnerability?
Well, you know, they've always been weak, Brian, you know, but they act strong because we never act like we know what the return address is. And, you know, I wrote this essay recently about the folly of de-escalation, and Donald Trump ended it. You know, what you always heard from multiple U.S. administrations, all of them maybe except Donald Trump's, his first one and his second one, that every time Iran attacks us, we're like, oh, we have to de-escalate. Well, you know what that did, Brian? It gave Iran the ability to escalate on their own terms with impunity. Donald Trump broke that trend, you know, when he killed Qasem Soleimani in January of 2020. And again, with this strike, he showed that he's willing to act directly against the regime.
I want you to hear what the Iranian ambassador to the UN said on Sunday. Cut 42.
Our peaceful nuclear activity will remain always in peaceful manner. So the enrichment is our right, an inalienable right, and we want to implement this right.
So you do plan to restart enrichment, that sounds like.
I think that enrichment will not never stop.
So if they start, and they're at Fordo now trying to see how bad the damage is, and I imagine it being significant, do you think that the Israelis are just going to bomb it away as they start to make some progress?
Yes. Yes, I do. And so this is why, you know, Iran's got to make a decision, you know? I mean, do you take the risk of restarting the program? You know, it's material intensive. And when you know that Israel and probably the United States will strike it again. And of course, Brian, you know, they could strike it, you know, with their Air Force as they have, but they could also go after them with clandestine capabilities. You saw an astonishing range of capabilities that included intelligence and direct action covert operations, as well as these airstrikes.
So right now we might go, I guess, talking to them again. We'll see what happens. But now there's pressure, and I think I think they're on the same page. There's a push now to de-escalate in Gaza. And they said the ceasefire is on the table. Essentially, they've wiped out all the leadership, including one of the founders of Hamas. But Hamas is still in Gaza. We've got to get the hostages out. Hamas has got this deal, the details of which I guess the U.S. side and the Israelis have. What do you think is going to happen there? What would you like to see happen there?
Well, what I'd like to see is Hamas give up all the hostages now, right? The ones who are living and the ones who they killed.
In exchange for prisoners?
I don't know what the outline of the deal would be. That would be up, I think, to the Israelis to decide, you know, but you got to get the people out of there. You know, right now the IDF is controlling, has kind of loose control over about 75% of Gaza. It's the remaining 25%, probably where those hostages are, and probably where there are a significant number still of Hamas terrorists. But you know what, Brian, when you look at this long term, too, near-term objective, get the hostages back. Long-term is you've got to destroy Hamas. I hear people say, oh, well, you can't kill an idea. Hey, as long as Hamas has the guns in Gaza, nothing good can happen for the Palestinian people in Gaza. So what you need, first of all, to have a relief valve so some of the Palestinians can get the hell out of there into a humanitarian facility, maybe in the Sinai temporarily. The next thing you need to do is destroy Hamas and get a peace enforcement force in there that can prevent them from coming back. Because until you do that, you know, nobody's going to be the mayor of Gaza, Brian. You know, you're going to get a bullet in the head. And you can't have Hamas in charge because, you know what, they're dedicated to the destruction of Israel. It is so hypocritical when I hear people say, well, we have to get back on a path to a two-state solution and we need to stop fighting against Hamas. Hey, Hamas has to go as a precondition for getting on the path to any kind of an enduring peace between the Israelis and the Israel and the Palestinians.
General, it must be surreal to you to see these signs in Syria that say, thank you, President Trump. And you have a leader, the president shook his hand and talked to him. I know you know he's a terrorist. He was a terrorist. He said he changed his ways. How do you feel about President Trump's bold move and somewhat of a risk to say, welcome aboard, we're lifting the sanctions?
Yeah, it's a risk, Brian, you know, but you know, the alternative would be to not have any influence or not have much influence maybe after what happens next in Syria. You know, Syria shattered during the civil war like a light bulb. And so that society's got to be kind of put back together. And it can only be put that back together if they end the sectarian civil war within that country. You know, us having leverage over al-Shaar, you know, I mean, the leverage we have along with the especially the Saudis and the Emiratis, and to agree the gutteries because we have to kind of pull them into this, is to not write checks. Don't write checks to them to rebuild. And so what that should be is, hey, al-Shaar, you need a pluralistic government, right? You need to ensure that these minority populations, like we just saw Christians mass murdered, like we saw Druze mass murdered, are protected, and that you get to some kind of a political process that's going to give all Syrians a say in how they're governed over the next couple of years. But what we don't want to see is another theocratic dictatorship in there or a caliphate, right? That's right. Going to consolidate gains and then try to export, you know, this radical Islamist ideology.
You could argue, General, that the president, that Russia had taken their eye off the ball in Syria, taken assets out of there, allowed for these rebels to go back and take back the country. So Assad had to run for his life. So as they've had to focus on the Ukraine, there goes the ripple effect, and Iran loses a passageway for arms, and they lose an ally real quick.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is really an important dimension of it. And Russia now is trying to double down on its so-called Africa Corps in North Africa and also move into eastern Libya. I think we ought to help people contest that. The other thing is, too, it's important to remember, you know, Assad collapsed because Israel kicked the hell out of Hezbollah, and Assad was really even more reliant on Hezbollah and an Iranian proxy army than he was on the Russians.
General, we have to do a whole tutorial and do 4 hours on this. There's so many moving parts, and it's always great to talk to you about it. So, General H.R. McMaster, thank you.
Hey, Brian, great to be with you.
You got it. Back in a moment. Brad Thor, the bottom of the hour. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So it's the trial everybody's been watching for the last 30-plus 40 days. Yesterday we heard that the jury on the P. Diddy trial had reached a verdict on all but one count. And now they've reached a verdict on all the counts. And he got off really well. I mean, 3 not guilty and 2 guilty. So the count 2, sex trafficking, not guilty. Count three, Mann Act transportation, guilty. Count four, sex trafficking, not guilty. Count five, Mann Act transportation, guilty. So he's not looking at life in prison, and I don't know how much prison time he's actually going to get, but the Southern District of New York, they say, doesn't lose much. But here, this is not looked as a victory for them at all. You know, he was up for kid. They charged him with kidnapping, arson, bribery, witness tampering, forced labor, sex trafficking, transportation for purpose of prostitution, drug distribution, and he gets away with two guilty charges and three not guilty. So we're going to see. I mean, he was looking for life in prison, and he's not looking at that now. So I'm not sure if they're going to bring that. I don't think you can do double jeopardy and bring this back again. But right now, it looks like Sean Combs acquitted on the most serious charges. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Brad Thor is next.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back with legendary author Brad Thor, number one New York Times bestselling author, continuing with his series. He's got a brand new book out called Edge of Honor, came out this week. He served as a member of the Department of Homeland Security's Analytic Red Cell Unit and has also lectured in law enforcement organizations over the horizon, future, and threats that are coming. Keynote speaker everywhere. And knows his stuff. You write fiction, but you base it on all real stuff. Right, Brad?
Exactly. I call what I do faction, where you don't know where the facts end and the fiction begins.
Right. So first off, the operation in Iran.
Listen, I am so glad we did that. Iran was, I can't use literally, they were asking for it. There is absolutely no reason
for 46 years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, the largest state sponsor of terrorism, they had their uranium enriched to 60%, which they absolutely did not need. It's a hair's breadth away from being a bomb. And, you know, I'm the son of a United States Marine. And if I think of Marines alone who had been maimed and killed by technology bombs that the Iranians were behind, it would have been derelict for President Trump to not have gone and done that, particularly with how degraded the air defense systems were for the Iranians. That was one of the safest times ever to put our pilots in that airspace, and I'm glad we did it.
So if you EFPs are
EFPs.
So those are the ones that are so detrimental and so devastating. You get hit by them, it's hard for you to survive it.
Yep.
But when you look at what they've been up to in the area, Hamas, obviously, Hezbollah, yes, mm-hmm. all the militias, Houthis. And the militias in Iraq. How different would have our experience have been in Iraq had Iran not decided to fund all the insurgency and actually take part directly in it?
Yeah. I agree. It would have been a much different experience. And we can go back. Brian, you and I have talked over the years. You know, one of the failings I feel in Afghanistan was that we allowed their constitution to be based on Sharia. There's just a lot of mistakes we've made over the years by just thinking people were going to go in and welcome us as liberators and all this stuff. And I'll tell you, I don't quote Ann Coulter too often. She had a great line about Afghanistan, though. She said, "You cannot give democracy to people that have more goats than they do flush toilets."
Right.
It's just there is not a spirit of democracy, freedom, a tradition there, and a wanting to have that stuff. So, but the Iranians have been incredibly bad actors throughout that region. I am glad that President Trump did this, and it was the right move.
As a patriotic guy, you must be heartened by the fact that the recruiting's going up on every branch.
We're meeting our levels. Yeah, it's fantastic. There is a pride, a reignition of patriotism, of pride, and to see young people, I mean, it's an all-volunteer military that we have. So to see young people standing up, raising their hands and saying, "I will go, I will write that check that says up to and including my life," it's fantastic.
We're up to year 250, and I think this administration is going to go all in on celebrating, including 249 is when the war really started.
Yep.
In 1775. And I think what's going to be really important on the 4th of July, that people start feeling patriotic again, not political, but patriotic. Overall, the Americans were asked, "How you feel about your country?" 56% strongly approve. Mm-hmm. That was at 2015. That was at 85%.
Yeah.
For Republicans, it's 83%. What does it take for the whole country? to change their opinion?
Well, obviously.
Or to understand what they have here.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of cultural division right now. And you get a lot of traction. You get a lot of clicks if you push on those fissures that exist in between us. I think if President Trump does the anniversary of our independence the way he did the military parade in his speaking engagement, everybody was ready to jump all over him because of the things he said at Fort Bragg. And they thought on his birthday with the parade celebrating the anniversary of the Army that we were going to get more of the Fort Bragg stuff that was going to be kind of divisive and everything. And he didn't do that. He gave a great speech.
15 minutes in and out.
In and out. Great speech. It was pitch perfect. If he can stick to that and focus on an American celebration, not a Republican, not a Democrat, not a Trump celebration, an American celebration, it will be one of the great things that's remembered about his presidency. I guarantee it.
I think I'm older than you, but I remember I was in grade school in 1776.
I was too.
Everything was bicentennial. Everything, whether
I did a bike parade, Brian.
Yeah, it was,
I remember,
nonstop.
Decorated my bike.
Yeah,
it was fabulous.
Right, and you would think of that at a time. If you look back just at numbers, I mean, you have interest rates to double.
Wasn't Carter the president? Then?
Carter the president. Yeah. Interest rates were double digits. You had gas lines. You had this Middle Eastern oil crisis, and
but boy, we were proud.
Yeah. But there was no, I mean, you could look at that and go, why America's not doing well? Well, back then didn't matter. You're still in America.
Yeah.
We just got to get back to that. And I think it's got to go to the education, books like yours.
Well, we have our old friend, Andrew Breitbart, God rest his soul, who said politics is downstream of culture. And he's really right about that. As the son of a U.S. Marine, I am very proud to be an American. And I try to – my books are about entertainment. You're supposed to take my thrillers to the beach. This book in particular was meant to come out before 4th of July. It's a thriller that happens in D.C. in the lead up to the 4th of July. I've got an American flag wrapping the book, the jacket art. And I hope that my patriotism, my love of country is infectious because I think it's important. I agree with you. We all need to get back to that.
So tell me about The Edge of Honor.
So Edge of Honor, got Scott Harvath, my recurring character. I tell people that my books are like the Bond movies. If you've never seen a Bond movie before, you can go see the newest one. You get caught up quick. Same thing with my books. But he's back. He's off his honeymoon. Scott Harvath.
Scott Harvath
back. He's off his honeymoon, and he's got a buddy of his from a previous administration who believes the Iranians are looking to kill him. And the buddy can't convince anybody that the work he did in the previous administration has put him on a hit list. And so Harvath agrees to protect him until they can figure out what's going on. And when Harvath gets to the bottom of it, he finds a shadowy cabal of elites in D.C. that want to overthrow the current administration and install their own guy and drive America in a direction that nobody wants.
So you took it from 2017. That's what it sounds like.
Because the first review I got said this book goes right down the middle. It is not political. But I do try to use real things from real life to make the fiction
fun. But you can see how
it
could happen.
Sure. Absolutely.
Right. So,
absolutely.
So you try to do that in a way that's apolitical.
Apolitical. And the book,
so where
did
you get
chapters,
your knowledge? Where'd you research? Who'd you work with?
So I've got friends from the first Trump administration. I've got a lot of friends in the intelligence community, law enforcement, the military. I've developed these relationships over more than two decades writing these thrillers. So I'm lucky. I get to go to the people that do some of this nation's most dangerous business. I buy a lot of pitchers of beer, a lot of steak dinners, and they're willing to talk to me.
So for example, if you're looking to guard a guy with a private security, mm-hmm. you will go talk to private security. How would you? This guy wants to eat at a restaurant. Where do you sit?
Yeah,
where do you
all
go?
That stuff.
Right. Where's the vulnerability here?
And how did somebody get a hold of Kristi Noem's purse? Could I have put something in Kristi Noem's purse? You know, when that happened to her in D.C. So I'll ask my Secret Service contacts, whatever. Because these guys actually read my books and enjoy them. And they're like, you get that right. Because if you get it wrong, you're going to hear from people.
But you know, George W. Bush, as you know, you probably were part of it. After 9/11, he said, how do I anticipate the next attack?
Yeah.
He went to Hollywood. And he said, what would you do? You know,
that
how
was
would
the
you
program that I was in. So they came to people like me, Michael Bay, the director of the Benghazi movie and the Transformer movies, and they brought us to D.C. and they said, guys, what would you do at home? What would you do overseas to Americans and American interests abroad? So this was this really cool kind of creative think tank where the government had realized 9/11 was a failure of imagination. They weren't thinking creatively enough. So they brought a bunch of us in and we gave them our ideas. And, again, as the son of someone who served, it was really cool to be asked to help my country without picking up a rifle to do it.
That's so interesting. So when you do this, you always like to leave it for the next chapter unless you retire. How do you leave us on the edge?
Uh, I'm a big believer in I think Studs Terkel said that the first chapter sells the book, the last chapter sells the next book. So you got it. You got to learn how to master those cliffhangers, but also pay things off. You don't want to end a book on a cliffhanger and tick off your audience. So I want to give people that white knuckle thrill ride, quick, short chapters, so they're easy to read in a book you can't put down.
What's going to be interesting now is 9/11 was a – you might say a lack of imagination, but it was, hey, I'm going to learn to fly. I'm going to take over a plane. Yeah. Planes exist. Flight school exists. But when you look at the next generation of threats, it could come from space. It could come from AI.
Yep.
Have you thought about incorporating something that is evolving in real time into a threat that could turn up in your book? Because you pride yourself on such realism?
I do. It's the key is finding a way to do it so it's grounded and it doesn't feel too much like science fiction, right? So I don't want like the Terminator where Skynet has become self-aware, that kind of a thing, and you're battling like a big AI thing. That's not my jam, because I do so much kind of old school tradecraft in my people. And, you know, there's certain tactics in the military. There's certain things that the people at the CIA do. And I try to base that on that kind of boots on the ground, touching things with your own hands sort of a thing. But the technology is an issue. You know, used to be able to get men and women in and out of other countries with false passports. Now, with all the facial recognition, you have to figure out how you subvert that. So the tech for what I do is constantly evolving, and it's something I've got to sit on top of and make cool. That's the thing for me. I want it to be cool if I'm going to put it in.
It's called Edge of Honor, a thriller. It's for the Scott Horvath series continues, and it's out this week. Brad Thor is our guest. Brad, when you talk about our intelligence agencies, they've been under, I guess, a lot of scrutiny lately. Do you believe that we're still the best?
Absolutely. There's no question. Nobody does it better than we do it. In any large organization, whether that's the U.S. government, the post office, Simon & Schuster, where I'm published, you're going to have issues. It is tough to run a large organization. You're going to get some bad apples in there and all that kind of stuff. But I would put the lives of my family and all the people I care about in the hands of our intelligence community, our military, our law enforcement people, any day of the week and twice on Sunday. We have the best people in the world.
So you mentioned, we were talking before about the Signal app and the controversy with the Signal app. But why would they use the Signal app, Brad?
Because it's easy.
And the Chinese have infiltrated almost every all of our governmental computers during the last administration. They said that there was no way to communicate quickly without using that. They briefed them saying use the Signal app.
Yeah. So Signal app was approved for low level stuff. It's like, hey, Brian, what wing are you at the Pentagon right now? Can I meet you for a coffee in 20 minutes? It was low level stuff. It wasn't supposed to be high level stuff. But the problem is, how do you separate that when somebody gets used to doing that? And the stuff that they have access to, somebody like Pete, you've always got a guy within arm's reach that can give you the encrypted stuff. But it is clunky. It is a lot to deal with. It'd be great if we could have super high level uncrackable encryption for all of our people in the national security community to use, so it's easy like Signal.
Makes me think our cyber defense is not nearly as strong as it needs to be.
We're not as innovative. We need to have a version of Signal. We've spent billions creating an encrypted network that people like Hegseth and the National Security Advisor, the president, can all use, but it's clunky. It is out of date compared to what civilians use, but it's more secure than what civilians use. So we need to figure out a way to make the technology that we have, the encryption, which is fantastic, it has to be as easy to use as Signal. That's the trade-off.
Are you heartened by the Silicon Valley seems to be on board with the Defense Department? That you have
until Google. The wind shifts and then they change their mind again. That's the problem. These guys are – this isn't necessarily the most pro-America group. They're pro-Silicon Valley. So we got their attention now in D.C. and they're willing to participate
Palantir
and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
I think it's very interesting that the AI people seem to be a little bit more patriotic than the social media people,
yes.
The Zuckerbergs. And
yeah, well, they're all out for – I'm convinced they're all out for themselves and what's good for them, which to a certain degree is capitalism, and I'm pro-capitalism. But I don't want to mistake their pro-capitalism position for a pro-America, pro-patriotic position. I'm not saying they're not pro-American. There's a lot of good patriots in Silicon Valley. But first and foremost, they're about what's good for Silicon Valley. So we need to harness that expertise in that ability, and we need to encourage it. Those are the kinds of people that I want to see the United States government – encouraging in innovation. You know, it's when we talk about the immigration system, there's so many smart kids here that I want to give them green cards the minute they graduate MIT. I don't want them going back to India and Italy or wherever they may be from. I want us to have the best and brightest minds here.
Well, the thing, there's no doubt about it. I think President Trump mentioned that. And he said, you know, why are we sending these guys back? We train them and go. But then there's pushback from people like by Bannon and others go, no, no, they're all going back.
No, that's ridiculous. That's totally wrong. That's ridiculous. If we can get great software developers, great physicians, great IP people, I want them here. And this is what America is about. We should want the absolute best in the world because it makes us all stronger and more successful.
Because they came here legally.
Yes.
And also the president's also talking about saying the meat packers, the agricultural workers, the hospitality workers. You've been here for years. You get a sponsor. Maybe there's no citizenship, can't reward bad behavior.
And they're paying into the system. They're not going to take out.
What about regularity with taxes? And then you have to pay them a wage.
Absolutely. And we're getting older in this country. We're not having enough young people. Who's going to man all the senior citizens? Homes. We need immigration. We need it done the right way. And I'm going to quote our friend Dennis Miller. Dennis Miller said, I love immigration as long as you come through the front door and you sign the guest book.
Right.
That's a great line.
So, Brad, congratulations on the book. Go pick it up. Edge of Honor, certain to be a bestseller. It's on the fiction list, but it's full of, it's called, you call it faction.
Faction.
But it's still going to be listed under fiction.
You got it.
Got it. Brad Thor, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Illuminating, intriguing, inculcating.
I know some of these words.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Senator Paul said that this was, that your vote was a bailout for Alaska at the expense of the rest of the country.
Oh my God.
That's what Senator Paul said.
My question was easy.
I didn't say it, ma'am. I'm just asking for your response.
My response is I have an obligation to the people of the state of Alaska. When people suggest that federal dollars go to one of our 50 states in a, quote, bailout, I find that offensive. Do I like this bill? No, because I tried to take care of Alaska's interests. But I know that in many parts of the country, there are Americans that are not going to be advantaged by this bill. I don't like that.
Okay, number one, Senator Murkowski just stared at this reporter for like 45 seconds. It was bizarre. And then she said, I went for the bill because she's got a situation where it's very rural, agricultural, spread out settings. So she had to get a deal that would, I guess, bridge some gaps when it comes to insurance. So agricultural has this big fund for agricultural hospitals, but for the most part, Medicaid has changed in what way? You have to be eligible for it. They're trying to get rid of people that are not eligible for it, that Barack Obama threw on this plan, that we're not supposed to be on this plan, that the federal government committed to reimbursing states 90%. So therefore, they were being totally irresponsible by people that they put on their rolls. They got Medicaid almost bigger than Medicare. So they slowed the growth of Medicaid from something like 40% to 5%. Only in America can you slow the growth of something and say you're cutting it. Number two, they're going to be checking eligibility twice a year. And if you're not eligible, you're going to get kicked off. They're going to be very vigilant. And number three, illegal aliens will not be getting insurance. That's going to save money. That's fundamentally what happened with Medicaid. But still, they're funding all this stuff. At the same time, we got to build up our defense. We got to build up the border. We got to be able to give no cash, no tax on tips, no tax on car loans, no tax on overtime. That'll help. A big tax break for seniors. Those are the things that'll help. Why she chose to sit there and say, oh, it's a terrible bill. Well, there's a lot of, in the president's conservative agenda that cuts down the size of government, but not nearly enough for guys like Chip Roy or the Freedom Caucus. And I tend to side with them, but you got to be practical. This is what I want, but this is what's possible. So when Chip Roy and these guys and Ron Johnson and Rick Scott look at this and say, this is what I want, what could I get? What's the best possible, most I can get? Well, cannot kill in the bill. And that's what these other guys do. And what Murkowski tried to do. Why she tries to walk it back and make things more difficult for the House to pass, I'm not really sure. But the things that Murkowski got, that upsets the conservatives in the House, including the ones in the Senate. How you win? Go to BrianKilmeade.com. I can't wait to see you in person August 23rd in Dallas, Texas, and September 27th in Richmond, Virginia.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. We get closer and closer to July 4th. Hope everyone takes a moment to celebrate the great country at year 249. Next year is going to be nonstop. We hope to catch up with Congressman Mike Lawler of New York, but he is in a meeting in the White House now. Why? Big, beautiful bill. Karl Rove at the bottom of the hour. We got so many political things to talk to him about. And before we get to the big three, let me just tell you, too, P. Diddy trial yielded a shocking result. He's only been found guilty on two of the five charges, including the most serious charges he's been found not guilty on, including sex trafficking and sex trafficking of Casey Ventura and of somebody else, Cassandra Ventura, the full name, but he's been found guilty of the Mann Act. And it looks like he could be getting as many as maybe 10 years in prison, but a lot of people think considerably less. Some people think home confinement temporarily when they get rid of sentencing. So what a dramatic change from life in prison to maybe getting out. And certainly he's not going to spend the rest of his life in prison. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
We're going to be watching that very carefully, and a lot of people are saying he's here illegally. He's, you know, we're going to look at everything. But and ideally, he's going to turn out to be much less than a communist. But right now, he's a communist. That's not a socialist.
Radical Zohran Mamdani officially becomes Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City. President Trump already coming after him, and he should. The entire party in a panic because this could be their future, which would be not a nationwide platform to win elections on.
Number two.
I think it's anti-American. I think the fact that you're going to have individuals and populations in there that are stacked on top of each other, many of whom without due process.
There's nothing about this facility, about this detention camp, that is not cruel and inhumane.
Really? That is so true. Immigration, a success story being written by President Trump as they talk about Operation Alcatraz over in Florida, a place to put the illegal immigrants who are on their way out of the country. There's controversy we'll discuss.
Number one.
It's the most conservative piece of legislation we've ever worked on. You need to mention at the same time that even though while we're having historic tax cuts, we also have historic savings. We're going to save $1.6 trillion for the American people.
There it is, Speaker of the House, hoping to get it through the House. The bill, the big, beautiful bill, back in the House after a dramatic win in the Senate, 51-50. But they changed some of it, and some people are not happy about it. What aren't they happy about? Well, if you look at some of the caucuses, the House caucus, it looks like some people are not happy. For example, Congressman Andy Ogles, he said, an unelected staffer, meaning a parliamentarian, appointed by a Democrat, meaning Harry Reid, rushed through an unfinished bill just so they could go home for July 4th. Their bill, meaning the Senate's, forces Tennesseans to pay for illegal aliens' health care. The House bill ended this. Why did the Senate keep it in? I'm not sure why they kept it in. I think the parliamentarian made a rule on that. Obviously, that's ridiculous, but these Democratic states want to pay for it, like California. So who else is upset about it on the big, beautiful bill? You have Ralph Norman of South Carolina. He says he does not expect to vote for the Senate version and opposes advancing it. Chip Roy of Texas warned the odds passing the entire package before the July 4th deadline after the Senate altered its House version are a hell of a lot lower than they were 48 hours ago. You notice he didn't kill it, but you know who did kill it? Elon Musk. He said at least $38 billion in government contracts, loans and subsidies and tax credits. That's going to be looking at since 2007. That's what the president's looking at because he ripped the bill. He said it's the worst thing ever. He's going to help Thomas Massie get reelected if the president tries to primary him. And he says he's not going to support any Republican that voted for this bill. Here is the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent. Cut to.
This is the signature piece of President Trump's domestic agenda. This is more than a tax bill because it also includes border, it includes defense, it includes school choice. And You know, I just had a meeting with some of the House Democrats, the Freedom Caucus, and I can tell you that group should be so proud of themselves. They have changed the center of gravity in the debate. We are going to start paying down debt. We're going to grow the economy. And they were big contributors to this. So I believe that at the end of the day, they will be there for President Trump and give Speaker Johnson the ability to move this bill to the president's desk for signing this Friday.
All right, this just in because it affects the economy. And this is what I heard. Once the big, beautiful bill passes, even though it's almost passed, got to pass the House, a trade deal has been done with Vietnam. After speaking with their leader, the highly respected General Secretary of the Communist Party of Vietnam, there'll be a great deal of cooperation between the two countries. The terms are the Vietnam will pay the United States 20% tariff on any or all goods into our territory and 40% tariff on any transshipping. In return, Vietnam will do something that they have never done before, give the United States of America total access to their markets for trade. In other words, they will open their market to the United States, meaning they will be able to sell our products into Vietnam at a zero tariff. In my opinion, that is sometimes referred to as the larger engine vehicles, which does so well in the United States and a wonderful addition to the various products. So I hope that's good for things like UNTUCKit, because I know they make their shirts there. I hope it's not cost prohibitive. Back to the bill itself. Here's Tom Emmer, the House Majority Whip. Can he get it done? Cut 7.
President wants the bill as is. Wants it on his desk by Independence Day. He wants to sign this thing and deliver on the promises that he made to the American people. And if you look at the bill, it basically is 85% of what the House sent over. So there are some changes, but I think they're changes that the president has adopted. He likes the bill. He wants the bill passed. We're going to get it done tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, I'll say, and tomorrow is today. So we'll see what's going to happen. Look, the president surprised everyone. The Speaker of the House got it done by Memorial Day. The Senate got it passed before 4th of July. The question is, can they get it thoroughly passed, both bodies, without going back to the Senate, because you can't go back to Senate again? Can they get it passed and go through now? Now, everybody else on every other channel is just ripping this package. Very few people have read 940 pages, I am sure. And most of those people had no problem with the new Green Deal that got jammed down our throats, the rescue package that was totally unnecessary because they say the pandemic needed it. No, Joe Biden needed it. Here's what CBS said. Cut 18.
Finally landed after a four-hour delay.
The weather didn't stop House members from traveling to D.C.
I'm not going to chance being stuck in Myrtle Beach in this historic opportunity.
Ahead of today's critical vote on President Trump's tax and spending bill.
My flights got canceled, and so we're going to drive overnight.
Illinois Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy hosted a Zoom town hall on his drive to the nation's capital after his flight was canceled.
We got some snacks, and away we go to Washington, D.C. And so wish me luck. In 14 hours, I'll be there.
So if these Democrats aren't able to get there and there's a vote, that could be the difference. And I know they had some who had passed away, and that was one of the reasons it passed the House. So they want to see who's going to get there. And we know the weather has been crazy, and the airports have been basically shut down. So they want to make sure these Democratic House members that they're there to vote it down and make the Republicans all show up and vote with it, or else Speaker Johnson will put it forward and that'll be it. You're not here. You're not here. Let's go. But he's not going to put it forward. Tom Emmer is not going to support it. Steve Scalise won't be behind it if they don't have the numbers there. Let's go to Tom in Connecticut. Hey, Tom.
Hello. How are you, Brian?
Good. What's on your mind?
So can you just explain to me, by giving Ukraine more Patriot missiles, how is that going to help stop the war?
Oh, number one, you don't shoot and defend yourself against an invading power.
So
give up Kyiv.
Really, Russia's going to come into Poland. They're going to come into Western.
Take Ukraine. Is that okay with you?
Is it okay with me?
Is it okay with you?
Ukraine, there's nothing left but Kyiv.
What are you talking about? There's nothing left. They've lost 18% of their country.
Nothing. There's nothing.
Tell that to the Ukrainians?
Who's going to fight the war?
So wait a second. So if they want Ukraine, you know what? Estonia is really small. You take Estonia too. Lithuania, that's tiny. Let them have it back.
Question. Brian, are you willing to send your kids to fight that war?
No American kids are fighting that war.
It's a yes or no question.
No
Brian.
American kids
Simple.
Are fighting that
yes
war,
no.
Tom.
Yes
it's a different question. Because no American kids are fighting that war. Send Patriot missiles there. We replenish our stock with the money that they pay us. So there is no deficit to us. And we show the world that Iran, Russia, China, and North Korea cannot run the world.
Brian, you should be a lobbyist for the defense industry,
really?
Honestly.
Really? Because you know what's wrong with the defense industry, Tom? It's too small. That's what's wrong with the defense industry. They can't build the weapons quick enough. They can't build them fast enough. They can't get it to the point where we can actually give people the weapons that they pay for, like Taiwan. So, good luck. Yeah, let Kyiv fall. I guess Ukraine's got a lot of damage. You could have it. Russia can have it. It'll be fun. Coming up next, Chad Pergram's going to tell me what's happening in Capitol Hill. The House right now has certain key members at the White House. They're trying to lobby them to vote for this bill, and they'll go back and do reconciliation after.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Senator Paul said that this was, that your vote was a bailout for Alaska at the expense of the rest of the country.
Oh my.
That's what Senator Paul said.
This one was easy.
I didn't say it, ma'am. I'm just asking for your response.
My response is I have an obligation to the people of the state of Alaska. When people suggest that federal dollars go to one of our 50 states in a, quote, bailout, I find that offensive. Do I like this bill? No, because I tried to take care of Alaska's interests. But I know that in many parts of the country, there are Americans that are not going to be advantaged by this bill. I don't like that.
Really? So if you can't get a bill that advantages 330 million people, I don't think you should pass it. It's unbelievable. I mean, the stare that she gave to this reporter, I don't know who he is, just looked like she wanted to bite his head off. That's why he followed up and said, I'm just telling you what Rand Paul said. But Murkowski got in there and got her hands dirty. She rolled up her sleeves and got something done. Rand Paul doesn't. They came to his office and they said, what can we do to get you on this bill? He said, nothing. Don't want anything. That, to me, is not doing your job. Let's bring in Chad Pergram. Chad knows everything. Chad, what's going to happen today?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. And I appreciate you suggesting that I'm a sage or a soothsayer here, but I really don't know what's going to happen today. What I will tell you is that they don't seem to have the votes right now to pass this bill. That could change. These things always evolve, but if they had the votes, they would go ahead and probably vote. Right now, they're on a procedural debate and then a procedural vote, and if that goes down, that will be a signal. It's a test that will say they don't have the votes. You can't actually get onto the bill if they're not able to get this across the finish line, and I can give you a range of anywhere from 12 to about 30 members who are against this. And, you know, I reported this morning that they said unless there is some divine promise from the president or some executive action that comes from that, they're not going to vote for this. Now, some of this is natural. Let's be clear here that you always have holdouts at the end on big pieces of legislation because they want to get their promise or their thing. It's an opportunity. It's an inflection point. So you just don't go along. You get something out of this. Look what happened yesterday, and you heard it in the soundbite with Lisa Murkowski. There was something that she wanted. She actually got things for her state. You know, this is a lot of horse trading. And with Senator Paul, you know, his thing that he wanted, he did not get. He said, I will vote for the bill, although there are plenty of things about it he didn't like if you remove the debt ceiling increase. But Lisa Murkowski actually came out pretty well for her state. And that reporter, by the way, that's Ryan Nobles. Ryan Nobles, who's the congressional correspondent for NBC and MSNBC.
So what changed? They say it's 85% of the bill, right? 85% of what the Senate was in.
The tax provisions are similar. Yes.
All right. So what is the big – what has got the Republicans so upset in the House?
Well, I think that they don't like the fact that the Alaska provision is in there. That's something that ticked them off. I think that the fact that the bill evolved so much, I mean, you know, there is a bigger debt ceiling increase in the bill. And then you have Chip Roy, who, and we've talked about this, and this is really in the weeds, but it's very important when they talk about the baseline that they're using for evaluating the tax cuts and the damage it may or may not do to the deficit. He argued last night in the Rules Committee and voted against it getting out of the Rules Committee. He said it's a gimmick. He said this is a stunt. He said we're fooling ourselves. So if you put him together with, say, Thomas Massie and a couple of other people right there, you don't have the votes. And I can give you a lot more, even moderate Republicans who have trouble because they think that some of these cuts were too steep, especially as Medicaid and Medicare.
So some people are upset that, I guess, is there funding for illegal immigrants in this bill? Because one of the Republicans said they sent to put that back in.
Well, they tried twice to put a provision in there that would have in the Senate, and it couldn't meet parliamentary muster with the Senate parliamentarian. Now, that was in the original House bill, and the reason it's in the House bill is that they don't have to comply with these special budget rules that the Senate has. And so the House can just say, well, why are we not having that in there? And then, as I say, blame the umpire.
Parliamentarian.
The Senate has agreed to have that as an umpire to comply with their budget rules.
Here's what Andy Harris said, the congressman from Maryland, cut six.
I don't think the votes are there, just like they weren't in the Senate initially until some concessions were made. We'll get there eventually, but I don't think it's going to be in the next couple days.
So, Chad, if they do make some concessions, it has to go back to the Senate again, right? They can't do
that. Right. That's right. And again, you're not going to get that done before the 4th of July. They're going to be lucky to get this done in the next 24, 48 hours. They do like stacking these things up against a deadline like the 4th of July or Christmas because it forces people to take action. But you're not going to get the whole thing done. The real deadline, if you're going to include the debt ceiling, is early August because that's the deadline for that. And then the question is, sometimes I've seen this with bills that you have bills that you can have one version pass the House and another pass the Senate, but you can never, ever, ever get on the same page.
I think it happened with the immigration at one point with George W. Bush.
Yeah, that certainly. Well, it happened in 2013. You had, the immigration bill. It was a bipartisan coalition. Marco Rubio was involved in this. John McCain was involved in this. Dick Durbin was involved in this. But they never tried to put it actually up on the House floor in that case. But there's been other things that were smaller potatoes where you just can't get it resolved for some reason, not as high profile issues as say immigration or the big beautiful bill. But what you could do is the House could amend it and send it back. This is what I call ping pong, where they're ping ponging the bill back and forth between the House and Senate, and that takes a long time. The other option, and John Thune has kind of signaled maybe he's not too hep to this, is to go to a conference committee. So the House passed its bill already, the Senate passed its bill, and so you take a congressional blender really, but then you produce a conference report, which is an amalgamation of both the House and Senate bills, and the House and Senate have to. Pass that conference report. It's just another version of the bill. And that can be hard, too.
It's unbelievable. Chad Pergram, thanks so much. A lot of moving parts. Unlikely today, but we're close to the big, beautiful bill.
We'll know tonight.
All right. Thanks so much, Chad. Appreciate it. Call Rove next.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Do you condemn that phrase, globalize the intifada?
That's not language that I use. The language that I use and the language that I will continue to use to lead the city is that which speaks clearly to my intent, which is an intent grounded in a belief in universal human rights.
Do you condemn that phrase, globalize the intifada, which a lot of people hear is a call to violence against Jews?
I don't believe that the role of the mayor is to police speech in the manner.
For the people who care about the language and who feel really concerned by that phrase, why not just condemn it?
Ultimately, it's not language that I use. It's language I understand there are concerns about.
Is this unbelievable? He will not walk back into a globalized intifada. I don't use it, but I support it. And look at other stuff that he said in the past, and look at the fact that he was arrested October 8th, the day after Israel's the attack inflicted on Israel. He's protesting against Israel and one of two lawmakers that got arrested. That's the guy the Democrats have nominated to be mayor of New York City. It is detrimental to their political fortunes, let alone to the city I'm in my view. How does Karl Rove feel about it? He's a former deputy chief of staff under George W. Bush, Fox News contributor, best-selling author. Karl, when you heard this and have been hearing this and hearing these sound bites roll back, what are your thoughts about this guy?
Well, obviously, he has previously used that language.
Of course.
He's previously said that, and I really love it. The job of a mayor is not to police the language. Well, let me ask you something. If some bigot showed up and started yelling racist things in the city of New York, do you think as mayor he would condemn that? And he should. But the fact that the man who aspires to be the mayor of one of the great cities in the world cannot bring himself to disparage, criticize, or disavow a phrase that talks about the globalization of the Intifada. The Intifada, 1,200 Jews in Israel died in the Intifada. And this guy wants to globalize it. Well, what do you think that means? And the fact that he will not condemn it and disavow it, or even consider apologizing for having used the phrase in the past, speaks volumes about who he is and what he would do.
He's also a socialist who's also leaning towards a Marxist. Listen to this.
What do you mean leaning towards a Marxist? He is a Marxist.
I want you to hear this about billionaires.
You are a self-described democratic socialist. Do you think that billionaires have a right to exist?
I don't think that we should have billionaires because, frankly, it is so much money in a moment of such inequality. And ultimately, what we need more of is equality across our city and across our state and across our country. And I look forward to work with everyone, including billionaires, to make a city that is fairer for all of them.
Yeah, if I could just take some of their money, I'll work with them.
Yeah, oh, I'll take a lot of their money. I mean, come on.
What are we supposed to do? I mean, we're sitting there. Yeah. Did he just won by 13 points over defamed and disgraced Andrew Cuomo? But it's not really about Cuomo. Any traditional Democrat would have lost to this guy because he outworked them, to his credit. And he got young people out there, those same people that we see protesting at NYU, at City College, at Columbia University, at New School. Those are the ones that voted for this guy.
Yeah, well, look, though, first of all, he is a Marxist. I mean, I love the language. They have too much money. Look, we all believe in equality. We believe in equality before the law. We believe that everybody has an equal chance to apply themselves and achieve things. But this guy says, if you achieve things, I'm going to hold it against you, and I've got, in my mind, an arbitrary amount that everybody should have, and anybody who's got more than that, let's pull them down. Let's take success and penalize it, and that's what is at the essence of Marxism, the belief that everybody needs to have the same drab existence that people had during the height of the Soviet Union. And I mean, this guy is a communist. Let's not kid ourselves. He is a Marxist. That's how he views the world, and that's how he would govern. That's why he could say we ought to have free buses. We ought to have free universal child care. We ought to have, I loved it when he explained, we're going to have city-run grocery stores, and they're going to be cheaper because they won't have to pay rent or taxes. Well, first of all, how can they get away with being someplace in a physical structure and not paying some rent or purchasing that building? And isn't it ironic that he says they'll succeed because they don't have to pay the taxes that private companies will? Those companies pay those taxes in order to provide the services that the people of New York want.
So we're talking to Karl Rove, obviously. Karl, so you have a situation. Tell me if you ever remember anything like this. Hakeem Jeffries, Gillibrand, Schumer, all have not endorsed him. I haven't heard anything from Dan Goldman, the New York liberal Jewish Democrat in New York. I don't know. Nadler, where are you? Congressman, well, Democrat in New York, a Jewish?
Yeah, Nadler endorsed him. I saw positive comments by Nadler, which I think is covering his flank in the Democratic congressional primary next year. But look, let's go back to this. You're right. This guy is attractive. He's young. He's, you know, he conducted a savvy campaign. He put off a good vibe. But let's also be honest. He was running against Andrew Cuomo. Talk about yesterday's news. Talk about a guy who ran a terrible campaign. Talk about somebody who did not come across as energetic and forward-looking and enthusiastic and got a vision. Say what you will, Mondami had a vision, and he made it look exciting. And, yes, he drew young people to him, but I don't think – look, I don't think the protesters at the colleges that you mentioned represent the majority of students on those campuses. I don't. I think a lot of people sat this race out. A lot of people came out because of the excitement. A lot of people came out because, you know, it was an open race. But I still think a lot of New York City Democrats said, you know what, I don't have very good choices. And I bet there are a lot of people who said, you know what, he's a little bit more left-wing than I am, but, boy, is he exciting and fresh and new, and doesn't he have, you know, some interesting appeal? And the only good – and they may have said – the only good thing about it is he's going to have to go to Albany for a lot of these changes that he wants, and he's not going to get them.
Well, really, well, if he has to leave the city council is as left-wing as him. But yeah. Albany maybe is a little bit different, but they still dominate, I think, with a supermajority for Democrats. So I want to ask you, Carl, if you're a Democrat right now, let's say you're James Carville, and level-headed thinking guy like David Axelrod, who you know, are you saying to yourself, man, I got to chart a future, and this might be the highest profile win we have, and this can't be the future for the country? We will die on the vine if this is the type of nominee we attract?
Well, I mean, that's one way of looking at it. Me, I've got a different view. I think the Democrats in Texas ought to invite him here and have him campaign across the state in order to help share his vision for the future of the Democratic Party. I think it would be enormously helpful. I think he ought to go to every critical battleground state. He ought to go to Georgia. He ought to go to North Carolina. I think this message is one that will be well received in Aroostook County, Maine. I think this is exactly what the Democrats ought to do. Let's put him out there now and have him be the future, the face of the future of the Democratic Party. I think we'll learn pretty damn quick how enthusiastic the people in middle America are about that. Yeah, let's do that.
So Joe Crowley was upset by AOC, and he was heading towards maybe being the next speaker, and he got upset. You know, same way Eric Cantor got upset. Maybe they got a little lethargic and got just they were assuming that they were just going to get reelected. They didn't. So he was a great booking for Brett Baer last night. Here's what he said about this. Cut 36.
I don't think that this election in New York City does transpose to across the country. What works in New York City sometimes doesn't work in the middle of Kansas, for instance, or where my wife is from. My wife Casey is from Montana. It's not going to work in Montana either. I think we can look at this election, learn from it as well.
He says it's not going to be a nationwide thing, but Democrats have to find a leader. They got rid of David Hogg. Okay, goodbye. And now they got rid of this guy. So, Carl, I want to talk about the big, beautiful bill. Do you think that it'll pass the House? Should it pass the House?
Well, I think it will pass the House, but it's going to require the president to twist some arms and for them to talk about some things that could follow that might make, we have one group of people who represent, sort of lower income districts where Medicaid is enormously important and popular, and they're concerned about the cuts to Medicaid. And then we have people who are concerned about the deficit and the debt, and they think there's too much spending in the bill. So there's going to have to be something. You probably can't solve all of those concerns in the negotiations and on the bill itself. You're going to have to commit to doing some things in the aftermath of it to get some of those people to come aboard. But it's going to require the president, and it's going to require a lot of political credit, to be drawn down out of his political bank in order to get it done.
You like it? You like it?
Well, I like. Look, it's not my bill; it's his bill. I like the restoration of his 2017 tax cuts. I like making some of the pro-growth elements of it permanent, because I think one of the most important things that the Republican Party can do is increase the prosperity of our country by growing the economy at a faster rate than it has been growing, by reducing regulation, drawing on America's great strengths like the energy industry, and cutting taxes in a way that it causes people who create jobs and build businesses to invest money, hire more people, and pay them better. So I like a lot of those elements. I also like some of the stuff we're doing on Medicaid, but we better have the president out there defending it. I mean, where are the three big savings in Medicaid? They come from saying that the able-bodied people who are on Medicaid, who don't have children, have got to work. And if you're not willing to work or be looking for work, you don't deserve to have the support of the taxpayers. I agree with that. I think most Americans agree with that. The second thing that it does is it says illegal immigrants should not be able to receive free health care through Medicaid. Yeah. And again, you and I are both big proponents of legal immigration. But I think you and I also agree, if you're an illegal immigrant, you do not have, should not have the right to get free health care that's not available to every other American. So no health care, no Medicaid for illegal aliens. And finally, the other big change is it says states should be able to review their rolls to find ineligible people whenever they want. The Biden administration said, no, we don't want the states to be checking their rolls as frequently as they like in order to find people who are ineligible. Well, you know, it's just common sense. If you do, the states ought to have the right to go out there
twice
and check the rolls.
They're asking for
whatever they want.
Yeah.
To make certain that people are not on the rolls. Because we have, look, they call it improper payments. Even the advocates of Medicaid agree that there are hundreds of billions of dollars over the course of decade in inappropriate Medicaid payments. And it's not just people getting on the system in order to get checks. You know, we just had the administration, the Department of Justice is suing, is indicted a lot of people who've been stealing money out of Medicaid and Medicare by
other countries.
By fraud. Yeah. So other countries, right? Exactly. So look, but to win this argument, it requires the President of the United States to get out there and make the case to the American people. So getting the bill passed is only part of it. He's then got to get out there and sell it.
Got it. So I want to get, you know, you are a great balls and strikes guy. You don't think Trump does everything right or wrong. You just call it like you see it, and you're a conservative guy and a political expert. I'm just going to roll off some of the things the president has accomplished. NATO is committed to spending 5%. University of Pennsylvania, trans men, you lose, go apologize. Virginia president, you're not, you're Mr. DEI, you're out. Canada, you try to tax our tax companies, the deal's off, they stop doing that. How about deals with the UK, now Vietnam, and a framework for China? Tariffs, revenue up to $162 billion. Supreme Court neutralizes the district court. He beat CBS, and they have a pledge to publish transcripts of political leaders for now on after their interviews. The Build Back Better is on the doorstep of success. The market hit an all-time high. They destroyed, for now, Iran's nuke program. Massive crackdown on TDA. Border crossings down to almost zero. This is a pretty impressive list.
Yeah, there are a couple of things that give me some queasiness, but it is a very impressive list, and a lot of it is very positive. You left out something.
What?
The border. The
fact that said zero crossings.
He was absolutely right that we didn't need new laws. We just needed a new president to enforce the laws that are on the books and to say to people, you come here illegally, you're not going to be let into this country. You're going to be returned to where you came from. I do have a little bit of concerns. UVA forcing out the president. What happens if a future liberal president says, you know what, you're the president of, let's say, Texas A&M University, and you're too conservative, and you will not allow, you know, blah, 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 or blah, blah, blah on campus. And says, you know what, we're going to cut off funds to you unless you're out. Makes me a little concerned. One of the great successes in there that is an important one for his political standing, you mentioned it, the trade deal with Vietnam. It sets the model, and the model is get make certain that they are able to sell us. Look, we're not going to be making jeans in the United States. We're not going to be making
shirts.
You know, tennis shoes. But we're not going to be doing T-shirts. But when the importance of getting the deal done with Vietnam and with Myanmar and Bangladesh and the Philippines and other sources of inexpensive clothing is that when kids get ready to go back to school, their parents are not going to walk in. It was a 46% tariff on Vietnam. You walk in
inflation.
To buy your kids' schools, and get that bill, that would redound to the disadvantage of the Republicans and of the administration. So yes, good that we're getting that stuff done. I frankly don't understand. The president's attitude is we're running a deficit with a lot of countries when it comes to trade, and the reason is because they're screwing us. They're not treating us fairly. Well, Britain runs a trade deficit with the United States. That is to say, we buy less from them than they buy from us, and yet we're still going to stick them with a 10% tariff. Aren't they supposed to be thinking the U.S. is messing us over like we say that a lot of countries are?
I don't know, but the market seems – a good point, but the market seems to love it so far. Karl Rove, you're the best. Thank you. Back in a moment.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Brian Kilmeade, for instance, who's always been pretty hawkish, and I think actually knows foreign policy and national security better than most people give him credit for. I think he actually studies it. He cares about it. He pays attention to it. And he's been pretty consistent.
So that was Stephen Hayes, wasn't it?
It was. Good
Where
ears.
Where was he?
He was speaking to our buddies Allison Camerata and Dave Briggs. He was talking about something else, but we're just talking about some people that might have flip-flopped on Iran, but he was giving you credit saying you've always been hawkish and you know it very, very well, which when we'd have him on all the time, it's a topic you guys would always discuss.
Yeah, I mean, that's so interesting. I'm surprised that did they counter that with something like, did Allison come back against me on that?
I mean, I didn't get to listen to the whole thing, which I'm sure Allison had some amazingly funny, sarcastic comment, right?
I know. She would be like, you know Brian Till? I know. So Allison's the best. And Stephen Hayes used to come on here all the time. Hope he comes back. But he started the Dispatch, him and...
He did, Jonah. I know.
Yeah. Jonah Goldberg.
I know. We do miss them both. They were both fantastic.
They were on all the time.
Yep.
We'll see more traditional conservative, like Karl Rove, that type thing. George Will. That would be someone like him. And Charles Krauthammer, perhaps. By the way, just a quick note, History, Liberty, and Laughs coming back August 23rd, Winspear Opera House over in beautiful Dallas, Texas. And then I want to see you. That's on the 23rd of August and the 27th of September, Richmond, Virginia. My chance to see great listeners in both those coveted affiliates. Be there. BrianKilmeade.com.
Fox News Audio presents Unsolved with James Patterson. Every crime tells a story, but some stories are left unfinished.
Somebody knows.
Real cases, real people. Listen and follow now at foxtruecrime.com.